All right.
Questions about the assignment so far? I've gotten a couple of questions that I've tried to respond to as pretty quickly on the mailing list. If for some reason you haven't gotten those, double check that you're on the mailing list. It occurred to me belatedly, I asked people to sign up for the list. Well, that morning I had killed everybody on the list because we had people signed up for previous years, and it occurred to me, if you signed up ahead of my asking you to, because maybe somebody told you you needed to do this, I might have inadvertently kicked you off the list, so double check that you're on. Has anybody not gotten anything for the list? Okay, are you on the mailing list?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Have you signed up?
No, I have not.
Why not?
Because I wasn't the first class, I wasn't informed of the mailing list.
Okay, it's your responsibility to keep up the lectures, so I was not informed is not acceptable. However, I do understand what you're saying. Are you the person who sent an email about this?
I sent an email out. I'm not sure if you received it. I didn't get a response. So.
Okay, where did you send it? I responded to email. I did get an email from one person saying, what do I need to do to catch up? And I responded basically saying, the lectures are being recorded. Here's the mailing list. Okay, so you need to figure out where you sent that. just to add to the confusion, there is actually another SHAP at Hopkins. And sending mail to shap@jhu.edu does not reach me. And that person, regrettably, is not cooperative about saying, got the wrong guy. Seems like a minimal courtesy, but that's not something we seem to value at Hopkins. Good. So why don't you take a minute after class and let me tell you sort of where you need to go to get on the list and get caught up. There's an assignment due Wednesday. And I'll let you know about that as well. Okay. Anybody else not been getting notes on the list? Okay, yeah.
Question on the assignment. Do you want us to bring that in, print it out, or email it to you, or submit it? Is there an online?
Oh, dear God, I don't want it printed out. Good. The question is, how do you want to hand it in, right? Yeah. I want it electronically. I want it in plain text as an outline. I really don't care how many spaces you use for indentation. I would prefer spaces and not tabs, because that way, if the grader happens to have their tab stops set funny, you don't get dinged. And I'm just looking for, you know, a single line that says what the procedure name is. Something like this. These are going to be long. So if your outline is running really long, it's not a mistake. Apparently, we're taking their lecture too. Okay, other questions about the assignment? I'll actually send out a note about this. I have an alias set up for CS318 homework submissions that goes to both myself and the TA. I want to validate that it's actually working correctly, and then I'll send it out to the list. But I strongly prefer that things go to that for two reasons. One is, things that go there, my personal problem is I get about 400 pieces of email a day, an appalling amount of which is spam. This is after the spam filter. And so there's always some small risk that I delete something by mistake. The CS318 homework alias, in addition to going to the TA and me, also goes to an archive file, so I have a record that things were submitted. And you know, once in a while, something goes wrong, and we've actually had occasion to look at the archive, so it's in all of our interest to use the alias. All right, other questions about the assignment? Other questions in general? Okay. Topic I want to start in on today is memory. And I want to open by explaining a piece of terminology that's terribly confusing because it really is confusing. There's a term that's used. Actually, not only did they take the table, they took all the chalk. Is there any chalk on the ledge over there? There's a term that's used in the memory management literature. Actually, there are two terms, and they're both some form of fragmentation. So here's the idea. Here's a big region of memory. And out of this region, I'm going to allocate pieces. Okay. So suppose the first piece that I allocate, right, comes from the very bottom of the region. So here's where I allocated, and this hashed area that I have drawn is the area that you were actually planning to use. You asked me for some number of bytes, and I give you a little bit more. And I'll come to why I might give you a little bit more in a moment. Okay? That little bit more is often referred to as internal fragmentation. It's unutilized space that is inside the unit of allocation but not used by the process and by the client. I'm going to go through this definition again. I just want to tell you in advance there's a confusion. That's the only reason I'm drawing this picture. So then I might go to the allocator again, and I might allocate some more memory. And for a variety of reasons, the allocator might choose not to put the new allocation directly above the previous allocation. Okay. You might say, I'll make a little hole, and then I'll allocate some memory. Okay. And maybe this one's a perfect fit, so there's no internal fragmentation. But this reverse hashed area, right, which I'm going to do with all kinds of funny hashing, it's called external fragmentation. It's space that is wasted that is not inside the unit being allocated. Now, there are two things about this terminology that are confusing. The first is it's lousy terminology. Because whether the fragmentation is internal or external is entirely a matter of point of view. This is something that I've never seen a textbook make clear. If I'm the client, what I know was I got this block. I asked for 33 bytes, and I got 33 bytes, and I may fully utilize it, or I may underutilize it. The only fragmentation I'm concerned about is how I use the storage I got. The fact that the allocator did something brain damaged is something that I may unfortunately need to know about for performance reasons, but it's already done by the time I get the memory. On the other hand, if I'm the allocator, knowing that I have some constraint on allocation and this constraint forced me to over-allocate might be something I care about. So every year, somebody runs into a place where they can't tell if something is internal or external fragmentation. Okay, and the answer is, yep, it really is confusing because it entirely depends on who's asking and what's their point of view. And I've never seen a textbook make that clear. So I want you to watch out for that as we go through definitions. A second complication is something called alignment. And I'm going to give you an example, and these, again, I'm going to come back through this whole process, through this whole topic this week. If I go and ask for, to allocate a string of characters, space for characters, technically, the allocator could give me back a pointer that pointed at any arbitrary byte, because as long as I'm starting in a byte address, I can put a one-byte character there. Right? It doesn't really matter if it's an even byte address or an odd byte address. But if I ask for integers, that is to say 32-bit integers, C-style integers, it actually matters what kind of address I get, because on most machines today, you can't load an integer from an address. If the integer is a 4-byte data structure, you can't load an integer from an address that is not a multiple of 4 bytes. So if you have an object that is 2 to the k bytes, right, and it appears at an address that is something times 2 to the k bytes, okay, or another way to say that is that that address mod 2 to the k equals 0. That object is said to be naturally aligned. Okay, and there's a rule in most processors, not on the Pentium, but on most, on all RISC processors, and there's actually a mode bit that controls this on the Pentium, that says if you perform a load at an address that is not naturally aligned, take an exception. Okay, so because of this, if I have the allocator, storage allocator, and I say, I need 3 bytes, the storage allocator, in effect, is not going to allocate 3 bytes. So what's going to happen is, right, here's my 3 bytes. The storage allocator is going to tack an extra byte onto this because for any given architecture, there is a worst case alignment constraint. There's some object size that's the biggest object that the processor natively knows how to deal with. On a 32-bit machine, that's usually a 32-bit integer. And therefore, so the allocator doesn't know in C what is your intended use of the storage that you're allocating. So it says, ah, I know what the use is. I have to assume that whatever the worst case alignment requirement of the processor is, that's what I have to return. And therefore, if you call malloc and you actually print the addresses that come back from malloc, what you will discover is malloc always returns on a 32-bit machine an address that is a multiple of 4. Because 4 bytes is the integer size, and that happens to be the worst case alignment on most 32-bit machines. On some machines, 32-bit machines, the worst case alignment is actually 8 bytes, and that's to deal with double precision floating point numbers. And there's a long shaggy dog story about that, but that idea briefly existed, and then it went away. And I'll explain a little later in the week why natural alignment is a really important thing to do in practice. So this extra byte is alignment overhead. And there's a question, is that byte considered fragmentation? There's no clear statement in any textbook I've seen about whether the answer to that question should be yes or no. And my answer is no. The reason my answer is no, the need for this extra byte is not a policy determined by the allocator. It's a policy determined by the hardware. So why do we care about fragmentation? Because we're interested in efficiency of storage allocation. This is not a negotiable inefficiency. It's not one over which we have any control. So when we're trying to evaluate allocators, we're trying to ask how much space do they waste? Well, look, if they didn't have a choice, you can't really discredit the allocator for wasting the space that didn't have a choice either. So for our purpose in this class, space that is associated with meeting an alignment requirement is not fragmentation. Okay, let me explain that when I know there's a terminology confusion coming up, even at the risk of getting ahead of myself, my view is better to make you aware of it so then you know what you're looking for when you go through the discussion. I understand I've just talked about something that I haven't properly introduced, and I'm about to go introduce it, but I figure it's better, even if you don't follow it the first time through, to say, here's what's coming. All right. So here's the memory allocation problem. I'm going to get asked for chunks of memory of a variety of different sizes. Okay, and let's start this in the context of the multi-processing model, right? I've got one program that wants 4 kilobytes of memory, I've got another program that wants 16 kilobytes of memory, I've got a third program that wants 12. I've got a fixed amount of memory. And at least at this stage of the story, I don't have virtual memory, if you know about that. Right? So I really just have a flat address space. Here's my memory. And I have to have some policy for where I'm going to allocate the storage. And that policy, on the face of it, looks like it ought to be simple. You might say, hey, my request will come in, and what I'll do is I'll just allocate from the bottom, and I'll proceed up to the top, and that's good, right? So I'll take my 4K, and I'll take my 16K, and I'll take my 12K, and that's good. And let's see, how much memory do I have? Do I want to have here total? Oh, well, this is a funny number, but let's imagine that my total memory is 48K. How many of you have ever seen a system with that little memory? Yeah, that's because you and I are both old farts. Okay, so I've still got, if I do my arithmetic right, I've still got a 16K region at the top three. Yeah, it's a reasonably efficient allocation strategy. By the way, free memory, right, is not considered fragmentation. If nobody's trying to allocate it, it's sort of in this limbo. Now, the problem with this story is that sooner or later we're going to run out of memory. And then what's going to happen is some of these processes are going to exit. Okay. So what can very easily happen is I could say, let me take another 8K chunk of my 16K. No, another 12K chunk. Okay. And now the situation is that I have 4K free here up the top. And suppose now this process exits. So my 4K process exits, and now I have 4K free at the bottom. If somebody comes along and they want to start a process that requires 8K, and I can't do it. The reason I can't do it is, until we introduce virtual memory into the system, or some scheme for relocating memory, I've got 4K free at the bottom and 4K free at the top, but I don't have 4K free that's contiguous, and so I can't do the allocation. And so the question is, if my goal is to minimize this kind of damage, what should my allocation policy be? How should I go about doing memory allocation? And just to foreshadow, this is why segments were really introduced. So a segment basically says, what I'm going to do is the thing that you think of as a pointer is really going to be an offset. So we're going to take the pointer idea, we're going to replace that with an offset, and we're going to interpret every offset with respect to something called a segment. And a segment is a base and a limit, or if you prefer, a base and a bound. And the way you do addressing in a segmented machine is you look at the offset, you say, is the offset beyond the limit? If so, this address is not valid. Okay, so the limit describes the length of the segment. In fact, let me call that base and size, because the limit lends itself to ambiguity. Alright, so if the offset is within the known size of the segment, then the way we'll actually find the real memory address is we will add it to the base. And so this means I could put your program in an arbitrary starting location in physical memory. Your program will still use offsets that are relative to the start of the program. What I'll do is I'll set up the base to point at the start of the program, so your program doesn't have to know where it is in memory. Furthermore, if I'm a little careful about this, it's not a very big step from here to say, and when a program exits, in order to solve the fragmentation problem, here's what I'll do. What I'll do is I'll recoalesce the memory. Right, so in a program matrix, I could imagine that I might take everything above it, pause each of the, you know, not run each of these programs. So while I, what I'll do is first I'll say, okay, let me not run the program in this 16 kilobyte region, and I'll move it down. Right. Now I've got a hole in the middle, and I'll move the 12K program down. Basically, I'll bubble the holes up to the top, or equally good, I'll bubble the holes to the bottom. The point is, this gets me all of my free space back into a reasonable contiguous state. And this does a lot to solve allocation problems. The cost is these copies are expensive. And they require not running the program while you're doing the copy.
Is there any hardware support for segments? Or is
yes, in so segments, I'm sorry, I should have made clear that segments is a hardware idea. And one machine is the half of their hardware supported. And they've gone out of vogue for reasons that are going to become clear a bit tomorrow. But, yeah.
When you rearrange the memory, do you try to form the longest contiguous block you can, or just move around enough so that you can satisfy the request you got?
Okay, so there are two ways you could do it. One is you could say, once I'm going to do the work to coalesce, I should coalesce everything. This would be on the theory that really the source of the work is that I had to stop what I was doing, so once I'm going to stop what I was doing, I should just coalesce as much as possible, and then maybe I'll get a bunch of allocations before I have to coalesce again. Second is, you could say, well, I won't do it at exit time, I'll do it at allocation time. But here again, now I have two choices. I either do enough coalescing to satisfy the requirement, which might be none, or I just do a grand coalesce of the whole memory system. You could do any of these. The answer is nobody does any of them anymore because nobody uses segmentation anymore. But the real answer is this actually is not a very pleasant way to think of segmentation. Is really not a very pleasant way to think about memory allocation. But before we do segmentation, yeah.
Is there one segmentation offset per program or per allocation?
Typically per program. Well, it depends on how the machine's being used. Okay. And how the language, so the one of the problems with segmentation was it did not map well to the pointer models that were used in applications. So the original idea of segmentations was it was going to be one segment per Pascal object or structure. And so in some sense, if you adopt that design, then the segment register is really an object pointer. And the offset is really an offset within the object. It's a field offset. Okay. That turned out not to work out very well because there weren't enough segment registers and it was a pain in the neck to manipulate them. So the next move was to say, well, what we'll do, we'll have two or three segments. One for code, all of your code, one for stack, and one for data. And the reason why the separate one for data from code is we're going to add permissions to segments, which I'll get to. And that model was the model that came into common use on the 286, although it existed on machines prior to that. And it's an awkward model. Mostly because managing units of allocation to variable size turns out to be quite awkward. Okay. So but let me finish the story about your variable size allocation. So one of the things that you can do, however, with segments is you can do something called overlays. And actually, you can do this in software as well. Early DOS machines did this in software. So you can say, oh, hey, I have this 90-10 rule. I'm actually not going to use most of my program most of the time. I'm probably going to run in some inner loop a lot of the time. What I'll do is I'll divide my code into chunks. And as the compiler, I'll try to be a little intelligent about knowing which chunks are the high-use chunks. And I'll allow the operating system to remove any chunk that's not currently being used. And now I'll divide my program up, even my code region, into multiple segments. And the idea is the segments that you're currently running will stay in memory, but the operating system is free to take the others out and then put them on disk, and it'll bring them back when you need them. So you may have seen the last time you booted a DOS floppy, if you've done this, something called HIMEM.sys or EMM386. These are actually software overlay managers that were used by some of the early runtime systems. All right. Let me go back to the coalescing because, yeah.
When you say it's written down to disk, are we now talking virtual memory or?
No.
This is.
We're not talking virtual. Well, we're talking about an early precursor to virtual memory, but we're not talking about virtual memory yet.
So the system needs to know when the stuff is going to have to come off of disk.
So the way you do this in software is, let's talk about code, because for data this is much harder. The way you do this in software is, you have something called a procedure table. And instead of doing a call directly from one procedure to another, the simple strategy says, for every procedure, I'll have an entry in this procedure table. The procedure table is going to stay in memory. Mm-hmm. And well, then instead of calling the procedure directly, I'll always call through the procedure table. What the operating system does is when it takes a segment out, it goes back and it patches the procedure table to point to someplace else. And someplace else is where it puts enough information to know how to reload what it needs. And there are a variety of optimizations you can then do on this scheme to reduce the size of the procedure table and to make local calls efficient. But that's sort of the baseline scheme. And you can do that in software. Your compiler better not making mistakes, right? So it's not terribly robust, but you can do it. And people did. The introduction of overlays on DOS machines was a big deal, because for the first time, you could do programs bigger than 64 kilobytes. For data overlays, segmentation really, really helps. You need something that serves the same role as that procedure table. It's called the segment table. And you really want to have operating system automation to support the reload. And at that point, you want some hardware assistance. All right. Okay, just like you could decide to coalesce lazily or actively or at free time or allocated time, there's another question. Maybe the solution is not to allocate variable size chunks. Suppose we said, well, I'm just going to allocate 16K for every program, and if you don't need it, too bad. If you need 4K, fine. I'm going to give you a 16K chunk, and the reason I'm going to set this policy is I don't ever want to coalesce, because coalescing is horrible. It's bad from a performance perspective, and it's awkward to implement. So in that story, what would happen is those first four programs that I talked about, 4K, 16K, 12K, 12K, I couldn't run them all at the same time. Because what would happen is my 4K program would come along, so here's my 48K. Being really bright, I decided I would divide this into thirds because that's a division that I don't actually know how to draw, really. So here's my 4K, okay? And because I've said I'm always going to allocate 16K chunks, I have 12K of waste. And as the classic literature would describe it, that 12K is internal fragmentation. Right, it's internal because the unit of allocation was 16K, 12K of which is not requested by the program is not going to be used. And for my next program, right, I'm going to have 12K, but since my unit is 16K, I'm going to have this 4K of waste. And same up at the top, because I happen to have two of these 12K programs, my middle program was 16K, so that's going to be a perfect fit. And look, the advantage of this scheme is I don't ever have to stop and move things around. And remember, if you're going to think about this, it's not really the cost of moving things around in memory that's the problem. Machines on which this was a major set of issues had reasonably small memories. They didn't run very fast to begin with. The cost of these copies was not pretty, but it wasn't something that was insane. The real cost is when these things go out of disk. So one of the things I want you to look for here is a lot of the problems that I'm going to talk about in memory allocation for main memory, they're not
really problems with main memory. Fundamentally, there are problems with, I've got a big bucket, it's got some kind of addressing scheme, and I have to divide up the bucket to hold variable-sized objects. It doesn't really matter if that bucket is main memory, or disk memory, or virtual addresses. Right? There are lots of resources that have this linear addressing property in which I have to do sub-allocation. So, look, the problem with this is, notice that of our 48K, we've managed to waste 30%, 33%, right? Because we've got 12K wasted here, we've got 4K wasted there. That was a third of the memory we had. So, the goodness was we avoided relocation, which is something that really you kind of want hardware support to do, and you might not actually have it. And the badness is we've got horrible wastage. Now, under what conditions might this be a reasonable strategy? Well, if you had reason to know that all of your programs were pretty close to 16 kilobytes in size, this would be a perfectly reasonable strategy. Or maybe they were all close to some other size. You might pick some size that was big enough to hold all of them. There's a little bit of variance, but the variance is not very big. You're okay. What happens if one of your programs is bigger than 16K? Right, you design your system this way, and somebody comes along, and they hand you a program that needs 17K. The answer is, I give up. Can't do it. What happens at that point, if you've designed a fixed size allocator, is you say, oh, well, there's going to be these outlier cases, they're really ugly, and I'm going to have to do one of two things. I'm either going to have to turn back to the program and say, great, you want to run that program? Divide the units of 16K and we'll talk. This is actually what happened in the DOS overlay model. The other option is to say, I'll have some fallback strategy. So under normal conditions, I'll allocate the 16 amount for every program, and if I get a program that's too big, I'll have sort of a desperation strategy where I'll basically start kicking people out of memory to get a bigger chunk. And obviously, if you want more memory than I've got, we're going to have a problem. Okay. Observation about policy. Policy mostly begets more policy. Anytime you say, I'm going to solve a problem by imposing an inflexible rule, somebody will come to you with something they really need to do that really won't fit the rule. So the argument here that I'm making is an aesthetic argument, it's engineering judgment. Policy is sometimes unavoidable. You're going to have to do some policy for allocating memory. You want to avoid it wherever you can, because every time you make a fixed decision in an operating system, you will have to violate it later. And what happens over time is the recovery strategies, right? You do something first that looks simple, and it works for a while. And then somebody comes up with something that it doesn't fit. And you say, okay, I'll handle that as a special case. And then somebody comes up with something else that doesn't fit. Now you've got two special cases. And pretty soon you've got 30 special cases, and nobody can understand what's going on anymore. So if you've got to pick a policy, you want to pick something that's as flexible as you can get and as non-invasive as you can get. And that's a very tough word to pin down because it's fundamentally an aesthetic judgment. But tip off, if you have some place in your system where you've made a design decision, somebody comes along with a problem case that you in principle could solve, but you're going to have to adapt the design decision to do it, it's time not to add a new design rule to consider the exceptional case. It's time to go back and review the original design decision. Probably either you made a mistake or there's some better way to solve the problem that wasn't apparent at the time. Accreting policy, right, only gets you a system that's less predictable over time. All right.
There's another problem with this fixed allocation strategy. Suppose I said to you, my fixed allocation strategy, I'm going to use 16 kilobytes, but it turns out that most of my programs are 4 kilobytes. This strike is a really good idea. I mean, I've avoided the copy problem, which is something I definitely wanted to avoid. But if most of my programs are 4 kilobytes, at least with a scenario of 4K, 16K, and 12K, I was using two-thirds of the memory. If most of my programs are 4 kilobytes, then my expectation in this policy is I'm only going to use one-quarter of the memory. Because for most of the programs, I'm going to have 4K in use and 12K is fragmented. All right, so there's a strategy here. In fact, there's several questions. Well, but before I get off on this next part, the other thing is, if I have a free region, if I allow variable size regions, in what order should I allocate them? Should I grab the first one that fits? Should I do some kind of a cyclical strategy where I have some kind of a pointer that's advancing in a loop through the memory and grab the next one that fits? Should I grab the smallest one that's big enough to hold what I need? These strategies are called, respectively, first fit, next fit, and best fit.
If your policy is that you're allocating 16K at a time, and you only need 4, so you have that extra 12K, could that be thought of because your system does 16K allocations, that extra 12K is alignment overhead because you're trying to align on 16Ks?
No, this is not alignment requirement imposed by the hardware. This is an overhead requirement imposed by the allocator.
So the alignment overhead is only if it's a hardware?
Only if it's a hardware issue. We do sometimes talk about software alignment for reasons of cache lines, which really we're trying to solve a hardware problem, even though strictly speaking the hardware would operate correctly, but more slowly if we didn't respect it. So there are some other alignment problems than the one that I mentioned, but this is strictly a software problem.
Could you explain NextFit again?
Okay, so NextFit basically is, okay, let me do FirstFit first. So FirstFit is I'm going to start at the bottom, I'm going to work my way up, the minute I find a slot that's big enough, however big it is, that's the one I'm going to take. And usually what I'll do, if I need 4K and I'm doing next fit and I find a 12K slot, what I'll do is I'll split it into a 4K and an 8K slot. The 4K I'll grab, the 8K I'll leave free. But the difference is in first fit, I always start at the bottom. In next fit, I'm advancing through memory, I find the spot for some allocation. Next time I'm asked to allocate, I continue where I left off and I go in circular fashion. So the question is, do I just keep going from where I left off, or do I reset to the bottom of the memory? And the reason it matters is, over the lifetime of the system, as processes come and go, and memory gets allocated and freed, what's going to happen is the fragmentation is going to get torn up into smaller and smaller chunks, and those smaller and smaller chunks are going to become harder and harder to use. The next thing I could do, I could say, well, maybe my problem was, I shouldn't have used a fixed size increment. Maybe what I should have done was use multiple sizing. So what I'll do, I'll say, aha, I have an expected distribution of job sizes. Right? So I know that I have lots of 4K jobs, and I have a few 12K jobs, and I have one 16K. So if I knew something about my distribution of workload, then it would be reasonable to say, hey, maybe what I should do is, I should say, hey, I'll have one 16K region, and I will pre-divide the rest of the memory into 4K regions. And what I'll do is, I will have two queues. So, this is the queue of 16K processes that are waiting to run. And here's the queue of 4K processes that are waiting to run. And when the process requests a memory size, what I'll do is whatever size it asks for, I'll move up to the next size I've got, because giving it less than it asks for won't work. But now what I'll do is I'll segregate the little guys from the big guys, and I'll design my memory allocation to match my workload. And I'll get much better utilization this way, if the workload matches my expectation. And even I could say, well, look, if I run out of the 4K regions, and I have one more 4K process, I can give it the 16K region, but I won't subdivide. The reason I don't want to subdivide it is if I subdivide it, later I'm going to have the problem. I can't get it back in the 16K region when I do get a 16K job. So what I'm saying here is that 16K job that's rare is important enough to me that I'm willing to dedicate a portion of my memory to make sure that when it comes along, I can run. All right, what's the problem with this design? How much money is going to be in your pocket tomorrow?
No idea.
How much money is going to be in your pocket the day after tomorrow? After out. You're undergraduates. You don't have any money in your pocket. This is actually very predictable. It's just like being married. I don't have any money in my pocket either. It gets even worse when you have kids, because then you really have no money in your pocket. Okay, but the one thing you could probably give me a reasonable answer to is however much money you have in your pocket tomorrow and however much money you have in your pocket the day after that, what's the likelihood that they're going to be the same money, same amount? Nah, you bought something, right? Or you went to the bank machine and you got some money. All right. What's the likelihood that you're going to have the same distribution of dimes, quarters, and nickels in your pocket tomorrow that you're going to have the day after? Roughly zero, right?
Or one for those of us who don't care change.
One for those of you who don't care change, thank you. I see you've been traveling in airplanes a lot. So, look, the story of it says I can predict what my distribution of workload is. It's a very debatable story. It's a very suspicious story. Bad enough to say, hey, I know what the biggest job is, because in reality, you don't tend to know what the biggest job is. But to say, I have a reasonable expectation that I have solid knowledge of a distribution of jobs in a general purpose system is nuts. Look, if I'm designing a fixed-use system and I know all of the activities that are going to go on it, and I'm compiling them, you know, at the time of building the system, it's an embedded system, right? Like my wristwatch or something like that. You know what? I know everything that's going on in there. There's no dynamism in the story. Nobody's going to come along on my wristwatch and say, by the way, I need 100 megabytes to compute the last inch of pi. I can pre-plan the storage allocation, and I don't need any fancy management. Great. Now, when we're done with both of those applications, we've got to deal with dynamic stuff. Actually, I'm being a little facetious, because it turns out that's 95% of the computing problems in the world, these fixed allocation problems. Likely you know what the distribution of workloads is zero, right? This requires, we have a term for this, right? It requires an oracle. They've been looking for one of these since Delphi, approximately 4,000 years before humans were born. And we still haven't found her. So if you have an oracle, great design strategy. When you find one, give me a call. Better still, play the stock market. Okay? But this is not a good strategy if you don't have an oracle. So now we're left with this problem that these static allocation strategies are not going to work for everyone. Did you have a question there?
Sorry.
You have an
order? What? No. Well, yes, but I'm confused myself.
Okay.
I just had a great idea. I mean, couldn't you just build several kinds of general purpose machines and several...
several what?
Like, you can assume you have different kinds of allocations. You know, instead of making one general purpose machine, make, like, you know, kind of a... with different memory allocations for different kinds of jobs.
Okay, there's a hiding in that question, there's a reasonable story. And the story is, look, the reason you wanted to share this memory was you thought at some level that memory was expensive. And it might be the case that memory is now so cheap that you should just run one job per machine. Intel, as far as I know, did not pay him for this suggestion. They would love it if you would run one job per machine because they'd sell more memory, more processors. Maybe the answer is it's so cheap you don't care. I don't think so. It is true, memory is cheap. And memory has gotten orders of magnitude cheaper than it used to be. What's not cheap is time. And when you run out of memory, you got to do something. So I think the answer to your question for general purpose computing is, no, I really need a general purpose allocation strategy. Okay, so let me... Okay, we got a break. Let me tell you what I'm going to start with tomorrow. I'm going to start with something called the buddy system. Here's the basic idea. I'm going to start with some power of two of memory. In this case, I would not use 48K, I'd use 64K. And I'm going to have some smallest unit, and I'm not going to go below that. And usually the reason I have the smallest unit is just for administrative reasons. Bookkeeping. What I'm going to do is every time I get a request, I'm going to take my available memory, and if it's not already a good fit, I'm going to divide it in two. And the smallest power of two that will hold the request, that's the one I'm going to use. When things get free, I will recoalesce the powers of two. And the tricky part about the buddy system is the ability to recoalesce. And we'll see why that turns out to be powerful. And we'll look at it, and then I will explain why the buddy system is actually not terribly relevant in operating systems, although it is a good, very good general purpose allocator. I'm going to divert from the slides, and I'm going to talk a little bit also about the strategy that's used by the GNU libc malloc, which is actually quite a good version of the malloc, and what it does. A lot of this stuff is driven by your belief about how much memory pressure you have. And if you're willing to tolerate a little bit of extra waste in low-frequency cases, you can often do much better than any of these strategies. Okay. I will also take questions on this tomorrow morning because I don't want to hold people any more than I already have.